Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our online editor, Emily Murray.
Hello.
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's suddenly, I don't know, are you feeling like autumnal? Because I don't know, like I'm starting to feel a bit, the seasons are changing.
Yeah, it's harder to get up in the morning. It's darker in the morning. I hate that. I can't wait till it starts getting lighter. But I do like the whole wearing of big coats and jumpers.
Mm, yes,
I like it.
I'm very much a Chris Evans Knives Out jumper style fan.
Yes, a cable knit, a lovely cable knit. Okay, so this week we are going to be chatting to director David Yates about his opioid crisis dramedy Pain Hustlers, and we'll be rating that, plus David Fincher's The Killer, Sundance hit Cat Person, Horror Suitable Flesh, Surf Doc Savage Waters, and Five Nights at Freddy's. But before we get on to those, what have you been up to this week? What has been floating your boat, Emily?
So I've been watching this Netflix series called Bodies. I finished it Monday night and you started watching it Saturday. So it's really, really good. It's probably one of the best like bingeable shows I've watched recently. So for people who don't know, it's based on a comic book. It's a simple premise that gets complicated, but it hooks you in because it's four dead bodies are discovered. It's the same dead body, but discovered across four different timelines. So you follow these four detectives, one in the Victorian era, one during World War II, one today's world, and one in the future. And it's about how their investigations collide and connect. I think I saw that, like, it was like trending. And I read that simple plot and I was like, okay, I'm going to check this out. It stars Stephen Graham. I love him in Boiling Point. I think he's a great actor. And it is just really, really like fun and thrilling and excited. And yeah, it's definitely, that's the thing I've been hooked on.
Yeah, I've watched a super secret coming out next year, Apple series, that I can't talk about. And I've binged that and it's really excellent. And I can't say anything else. Shall we talk about what we can talk about? Shall we start with this prescription? It's this.
It's commissions that get you into paradise. Get a doctor to prescribe your drug. You know when we bill on a full dose script?
What?
40 grand.
A year?
A month.
On some level, I knew it was bullshit.
It's a long odds lottery ticket buried under 1,000 rejections. And you gotta have the grit and the balls to reach down and scratch it.
There's nothing so inspiring as sheer desperation.
You're not going to make 100K this year. It's going to be more like 600.
So this is Pain Hustlers, the true story of a pharma upstart company who bent the rules to make big bucks and hooked patients on pain meds. Before we talk about whether this is a pleasure or a pain, let's hear what Harry Potter director David Yates had to say about tapping into real life and leaving the Fantastic Beasts behind when I sat down with him to talk about this last week.
If you don't grow, you die. Sales are flat.
Sales are flat at $170 million a quarter.
Like that! Use your crisis as your fire. You'd be amazed at what you're capable of.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on Inside Total Film podcast. I'm a massive fan of your work as a journalist. You know, State of Play was such a huge thing for me as a person growing up wanting to write for papers. And although you've sort of done a lot of, you know, the Wizarding World and everything since then, this film feels like a sort of return to that vibe. Would you agree?
I would agree. It is a return to my roots in some ways. And that's what I loved about the script. Wells Tower, we developed the script with Wells Tower over about 2-3 years. And I loved Wells' writing. He's great with character. But as Paul Abbott, who wrote State of Play, did, he brings a kind of subversive wit to the drama, which I adore. And the fact that, you know, when you make those Wizarding World films, they are, you know, they're somewhat heightened. And the great thing about this story is it's in contemporary America. It's the here and it's the now, kind of, even though it's set a few years ago. And that appealed to me enormously, that I could move the camera across a landscape and everything within that landscape was real. It wasn't green screen. It wasn't, you know, something that we had to put in later. It was all present and real. And that, to me, exactly, State of Play was shot in exactly the kind of same way. It was all there in front of you. And there's something quite spontaneous and enjoyable about that.
Also, this was obviously based on a book, Evan Hughes's book, so about real events with John Kapoor and his pharma startup. But you decided to sort of just take it into a fictional world. What does that do that doing it as a sort of documentary doesn't?
So it gives you license to create characters that the audience can engage and invest in.
Yeah.
A straight documentary doesn't give you that leeway quite. And by the way, the book, as you know, is really meticulously researched and it's densely researched. So it's a fantastic read. But in terms of a piece of drama that you want to be shown all over the world and accessible and engaging for audiences all over the world, you take the jazz of that wonderful detail that Evan had created and you kind of reorchestrate it for a sort of more universal parable, if you like. And so we created the character of Liza Drake as a fictional centerpiece for us, as a character that we could all invest in and follow on this journey. And we're very keen at the outset. We're telling a story set in a world that is, you know, has some pretty serious and deep issues ongoing within it.
Yeah.
And we wanted more than anything, our ambition was to entertain the audience, to bring them into the world, to give them a bit of a wild ride before we started to deal with the seriousness at the heart of the story. And so you need to fictionalize a wee bit to do that. And our big note to Wells as he started to write the first couple of drafts of the script is, don't be afraid to bring some character humor in here that we can really all relate to, that'll pull an audience on side. And the ambition was by the end of the movie, the audience will be more reflective and more open to the messages underlying the film than if we'd made a straight, serious documentary.
Yeah, so it doesn't feel like homework. It's something that's just getting under their skin.
Exactly. It doesn't feel like homework. Or as Lawrence, my lovely co-producer, would often say, this is not a movie where we want people to eat their vegetables. This is entertainment, but with an issue at the center of it.
Obviously, you've got Emily Blunt in this role, which I think is quite a departure for her as well. I don't think I've really seen her play this before. Obviously, we can't talk to Emily because of the strikes, but what did you and she talk about when you discussed this role?
We both were drawn to Liza Drake as a character, someone who's undervalued, underappreciated, didn't get a fancy education, had to still find her way through the world and prove herself. And her superpower as a character is this extraordinary empathy and ability to read people and to bring them on side. And we both loved the idea that we were making a film about someone who would often be the least important person in the room if you looked at a boardroom. And Emily loved the idea of playing also someone who is on a sort of moral maze of a journey, someone who ends up doing things which could be questionable. You know, she's doing them for the right reasons. Emily loved the idea that this character is a little bit shady, is a little bit bad. And she would often say, as we were working on the script and she would read drafts, it's so refreshing to see a female character who isn't the perfect mother or perfect sister. You know, often she gets roles sent to her where the women are all saints. And we didn't want a saint. We wanted someone who was as flawed and as complicated and as vulnerable as we all are at times in our life. And so that's what we loved about Liza Drake.
And then you put into that Captain America, just totally turning his shield to play a sleazy farmer rep. Was that a similar sort of attraction for Chris Evans that he wanted to play in that sort of sandbox?
Yeah, completely. We're all completely used to Chris playing these alpha male figures. So to give him a character that's slightly sleazy and a little bit broken, someone whose life is about transactional relationships, how much money can we make? You know, it was a real draw for him. It got him the opportunity to flex a different set of muscles to the ones he normally flexes. And he relished it. He relished it. The first day of shooting, we were doing one of those interviews where he's in a box and he's just talking. We sort of ran through the whole interview stuff with him. And right from the get-go, he was channeling this different human being that I hadn't seen him explore before. And I could tell he was enjoying every single minute of doing that because, you know, you're bringing to the table something that people don't often ask you to bring. And that was the big appeal for him.
Yeah. And is that your voice we hear off camera asking the questions?
That's actually Cliff Lanning, who is my first assistant director and will use any opportunity to get into the movie. And I encourage him to because, by the way, he's a brilliant first assistant director because he makes it fun on the floor for everybody. So he's a sort of real, he brings people together. I worked with him once before on Order of the Phoenix and he's in that movie, actually. He's in one of the photographs because, again, he just can't help but want to get in front of the camera as well as work behind him. So when he said, "David, David, David, can I ask the questions?" I said, "Absolutely, Cliff, you go ahead."
Yeah.
And he does it really well. He does it in that really droll kind of, he got the sort of pitch of it perfectly right.
Yeah. Speaking of Harry Potter, I can't let you go without asking about Fantastic Beasts and yes. what we might expect from it. I know you can't tell muggles anything, but can you give us a generality of what we might expect from the next installments?
You know what we're doing with Beasts for a minute is it's all just parked. We made those three movies. We made the last one through the pandemic and it was enormous fun, but it was tough. We were actually filming when there wasn't a vaccine. Thank goodness no one got sick, but we put the most detailed protocols in place. And then we got to the end of FB3 and we're all so proud of that movie. And when we went out into the world, we just needed to sort of stop and pause and take it easy. And the idea that there were going to be five films was a total surprise to most of us because Joe just mentioned it spontaneously at a press screening once. We were literally, I think we were presenting FB1 or we were presenting a sort of some clips of FB1 and we'd all signed up for FB1 very enthusiastically. And Joe, bless her, came on and I was there with Eddie and the other actors and we were here, you know, talking about the movie that we were making that we were very excited about, that first Fantastic Beasts film. And Joe said, "Oh, and by the way, there's five of them." And we all looked at each other because no one had told us there were going to be five. We sort of committed to this one. And so that was the first we'd heard of it. But in terms of our cycle of production, we've all come out of the third one. You know, it was a wonderful experience to make that movie, but we're just all just taking a pause. And I haven't spoken to Joe and I haven't spoken to David Heyman. I haven't spoken to Warner Brothers. We're just taking a pause. And it's quite nice. And it allows me to do stuff like this. Mm. And other things I've got lined up that I'm excited about. But I'm sure at some point, Newt may well be back. Who can tell? We haven't got any in-depth conversations at the moment.
So Payne Hussars, Emily, who is in this and what exactly are they flogging?
So Emily Blunt plays Liza Drake, who's a single mom trying to make ends meet. And she's working at a strip club where she meets Chris Evans, who is like a pharmaceutical salesman, I guess. And he says to her, "Come with me and you can make thousands and thousands of dollars." And so she does. This is about the opioid, you know, epidemic that we have seen on screen before in the likes of Dope Sick, etc. And sort of talks about capitalism, the American healthcare system. And it's about how they, I suppose, tap into, the corruption there.
Yeah. And it's obviously a true story. It's based on a book. You can Google to see what happened to these people. Liza, as David said, is a sort of creation that's made for this film, so that we have somebody to sympathise with. Does that work for you? Do you feel that Liza is a sympathetic character? Does Emily Blunt manage that trick?
In a way, yes. I think it does a good job. I think mostly because of her. I think Emily Blunt's brilliant in general in everything that she does. I don't think she's ever turned a bad performance. I always remember her from like A Devil Wears Prada when I watched that growing up. And I was like, I love this woman, whoever she is. I think she's just endlessly watchable. And I think she walks a very fine line of, I am sympathetic, but also I recognise she's not, you know, what she does here ain't great. Mm. And I think it's a really fine line, but I think she walks that quite well. My main problem, though, I suppose, with the movie in general is I don't think it dives enough into the topic. I think it's trying to make you think about the class system, the problems with healthcare in America, and the morals that these characters have. But it feels quite surface level in a way. Yeah, I think it could have done more to explore that. But I do think the big win here is Emily Blunt. I think if she wasn't so wonderful, I think it would have lost me.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers, that huge charisma that both women bring to the role, that, you know, they're doing bad things, but you do understand what's driving them. And also the fact that they have morals about it, even if they're quite skewed. And yeah, as David Yates did say, you know, this is not a take your medicine film. He didn't intend for this to be something that was sort of very much about the politics and everything else. This is supposed to be fun. So maybe that's a disconnect a little bit. But for me, it sort of played a bit like a female Wolf of Wall Street, very sort of stylized in a Scorsese fashion with freeze frames and sort of voiceovers and horrible baying people cheering at the amounts of money that they're making. So, you know, I think if we're going to forgive Scorsese for it, I think I forgive Yates for it. And to that end, I sort of found it quite an enjoyable thing that I didn't really think very much about afterwards. But as I watched it, I very much enjoyed Emily Blunt's outfits, her accent,
yes.
The sort of cheeky way she went about things, and watching Captain America be a total sleazebag.
I love how, since he's sort of retired from Captain America, Chris Evans just loves playing like horrible, malicious characters. I think he does it really well. You are right. Like, I had fun watching it. It's very glossy, like there's a shine to the whole film, and it's colourful, and I think it's really bright, and it instantly like draws your attention. Like the party scenes are really vivid on screen, so you are right, but it's enjoyable, entertaining. I think if you watch this like on Netflix one night, you'll have a good time with it.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'll ever think about this film again. And maybe even if I want to dive more into that epidemic, like I haven't actually seen the likes of Dope Sick, like other films and TV shows that address that. And I suppose I can then go watch those if I want to sort of have maybe more of a serious look at it.
Yeah, I think it's a good jumping off point that if you did, Dope Sick would be a great stop off to go to next, to sort of look about, because this isn't at all about the victims. You know, they do pop up and they sort of have these to camera moments, but really it's not about that. It's about, look at these really dreadful people doing really dreadful things, but actually it's kind of fun. And that's terrible. So if you actually want to know about what it feels like to be at the receiving end of that, and how that destroys your life and how that addiction is absolutely crippling, then you want something like Dope Sick and the giant industry of this. I mean, we see it in this film. It is incredible when you actually think about it that, you know, prescriptions can be this fallible, and that people can be diagnosed with a pain medication that's supposed to be specifically for cancer, but it's being sent out for headaches and all sorts of things just to get those numbers up. And that is horrific. And you just can't really believe that happened, but obviously it has. So this is available on Netflix. Perfect place for it, would you reckon?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you watch it like Friday night, takeaway movie, you're not going to be disappointed in the moment.
Okay, so this is Pain Hustlers, and it hits Netflix on Friday. Right, from one set of people making a killing to another, it's this.
Stick to your plan. Never yield an advantage. Stick to the plan. Fight only the battle you're paid to fight. Ask yourself, what's in it for me? Stick to the players. Empathy, weakness, and vulnerability. This is what it takes if you want to succeed. Simple.
So this is The Killer. This is Michael Fassbender as an assassin. This was a film that was taken to Venice and people thoroughly enjoyed. Emily, tell us a little bit more about it.
Michael Fassbender plays a hitman. And I'm trying to like not like go into spoilers here, but let's just say something happens with one of his kills at the start of the film, and it has quite a bit of an impact on him. And we sort of followed the consequences of that as he tries to dive deeper into the wider conspiracy.
Yeah, and this is David Fincher. We last saw him with Mank, which was a very different film. Where would you put this in the Fincher oeuvre? Where does it sit?
I'm a huge Fincher fan. Like, he's one of my favourite directors of all time. So I was very excited for The Killer. I know quite a lot of people like are divisive over Mank, but I quite like Mank, actually. Like, it is different, as you say, like, but I think it's beautiful and really well executed. I was disappointed in it.
Oh.
So I wouldn't rank it very high on his filmography. I don't know, that feels like a damning criticism when it's not, because I think loads of his films are like 5-star bangers.
Yeah.
he has set the bar so high for himself. Because I didn't think this was bad. Like, I did actually quite like it. I really enjoyed it. I think for me, for Fincher, for someone who's made like Gone Girl, Seven, Going Down to Two, like these quite complex thrillers, I found this maybe a little too straightforward for him.
But did you not think it was like Gone Girl? It's exactly that sort of thing for me. It's David Fincher saying, I'm going to take something quite pulpy and straightforward, and I'm going to do it and just do it to the very best of my ability, beautifully calibrated with a great central performance that's incredibly intense and watchable. And you are going to eat it up, and you will know that I can do other things, but this is what I can also do, and just do a fun film and do a Saturday night good time that sort of recalls, you know, old films that we've seen before, but with a Fincher finesse on it. I sort of think this is him flexing, you know, that I can do this in my sleep. I can do this. And I feel like Gone Girl is very much like that. I don't think Gone Girl is complex. I think it's quite the opposite. So for me, this was one of those delicious morsels, bonbon that he serves up in between his other work.
Yeah, it is interesting to say that. And it's interesting that you call it fun, because I didn't have much fun with it. I think the music's incredible. Like, I love the Smiths and I love the Needle Drops. And I think that is quite fun, to be fair. And some of the lines are slightly funny, but I found it quite cold, actually. But I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because I think it's really an interesting analysis of this hitman's mind and Michael Fassbender's monologue, the way that it's brought to screen. I think the sound design, by the way, is like one of the best things about this movie, the way it immerses you in his mind and it weaves in his narration. But I can't say I had fun with it. So I think it's really interesting that you say that. You are right that it's pulpy, it's based on a graphic novel. I think that comes across quite well. It is very neo-noir. But I just found it a bit boring, Jane.
Oh, I mean, I saw it at Venice. And as you know, when you get into a festival thing, when you see something that's enjoyable, when you've just watched, you know, Aggro Drift for an hour and a half, really, frankly, anything is going to be better than that. So perhaps I have been tempered by that. But what I liked about it was this idea of somebody who, you know, he sets it up, as you say, with the narration that he has all these rules, never, you know, get engaged, never give an advantage, never do this, follow the plan. And the whole film is about him not following a plan and going completely off plan, and how that, you know, ends up with fights in houses that involve cheese graters, which I found amusing. And that as soon as you actually do go off plan, then everything goes to hell. And I really enjoyed scenes with the people that he interacted with. So particularly Tilda Swinton as a fellow killer. And the fact that when he shows up at your door, people who live in this world understand that it's game over. And the sort of strange calm that they have in that situation, that they know he doesn't turn up to give you good news. You know, he's appeared in your office and it's all going to go wrong from there. So I liked the clinicalness of that, and the fact that he was like a surgeon in the way he conducted this and the way he cleaned up afterwards. And maybe it's just my fascination with these type of people. I'll watch any mass murderer documentary on Netflix because I'm fascinated by forensics and the things that people do and the sort of cleaning up after themselves and their motivations. And so it felt very much like a person that I could believe existed in the world, but perhaps he didn't to you.
Because it does sound like I'm being harsh, because I do really like this film. I think maybe my expectations were too high. Like when you said, like, it feels like David Fincher could do this in his sleep, like, I agree, but in a bad way. I don't think he's pushing himself at all with this film. Like, on a technical level, it's perfect. The cinematography is stunning, the sound design. I think Michael Fassbender is brilliant. I did like, as you say, the clinical nature. I just wasn't entertained by it. And I feel like it's something I've seen before in terms of sort of the analysis of a hitman's mind. What I find interesting is how you said you watched it at Venice, because my screening experience was me and four men in a room in Soho. And I wouldn't say that's like maybe the best way to watch it, because I think maybe if I had watched it with a crowd, like a packed audience, maybe then the fun aspects would have been brought out more.
Yeah. Because there are laughs in it. You know, he talks about dressing like a German tourist and things like that. You know, there is amusing things that did get laughs in the room. And the sort of vibe when I was watching it was people were going, oh, wow, this is a hoot. I mean, it was on a level of enjoyment with how the audience felt watching Hitman, another assassin, I think, but very different and more sort of. And again, that's Linklater doing the same thing, going, I'm going to do a Hitman film and I'm going to do it like it's a really sort of easy breezy, enjoyable thing. And look what I can do. And the next one's going to be different. So to see both of those films at Venice and to see both sort of elicit a similar response was quite interesting.
Yeah, there wasn't much. There was like no laughter in this screen I was in, except for maybe the odd chuckle from me.
So maybe it's a film you do need to go and see at the cinema with your condiments and enjoy with people, maybe.
I think so.
Maybe you just don't work well alone, Emily. You know, you need to be with a group. You're like the killer. You're just doing your yoga in your screening room.
I am like the killer.
And checking out your pulse rate. And really what you need to be is out and with people.
Exactly. I do wonder how it'll play on Netflix. I think a lot of people will turn it off after the first 15 minutes when it's just Michael Fassbender's narration and nothing's really happening except for his monologue. Because I think people will be like, is it all like this? Like, it's not. but I'm wondering how people will react to that opening.
Well, we would suggest that if you do watch it on Netflix, when it's on Netflix on the 10th of November, that you go further than the 15 minutes.
Yes,
do, because there's some great wheelie bin action and, as I say, a wonderful cheese grater employed and dog action and various other things. But it is in cinemas from Friday. So if you do fancy seeing it with a crowd, you can do that as well. So I'm going to say I highly recommend it.
I recommend it. It's not top tier Fincher for me. I was a bit sad walking out of that screening room, Jane, I have to admit.
Okay. You know, can't please all of the people all the time, as they say. So I liked it, David. Emily would like to see a little bit better from you next time. Those are our notes. Okay, time for date night at the cinema now with this.
I had a good time tonight. Didn't you?
Yeah.
So what was his go-to move? The reverse squatting cowgirl? Were his cats at least cute?
I never saw them.
Uh-oh.
Why lie about having cats?
Because liking cats makes a guy seem non-threatening. Harmless. He's hiding something.
I'm the monster. So this is Cat Person. This was a hit at Sundance earlier in the year. I saw it in January at Sundance. It's not about cats per se, is it?
No, if you're expecting cats, you might be disappointed. Instead, it's about the world of modern dating, although my cat has now appeared.
Hello, Holmes. He's currently drinking out of the sink behind Emily.
He is. He's not a very polite company, clearly. Well, actually, exactly like some of the people in this film. It's based on a viral short story. Did you read a short story? Because I haven't actually read it.
I haven't. My only access to this is this film. So I need to probably go back and read it. It was a New Yorker, wasn't it?
It was a New Yorker and it went super viral. But somehow I also missed the short story. And it follows Margot, who here is played by Emilia Jones, who you would have seen, hopefully, in the award-winning, Oscar-winning Coda. And she plays Margot, who starts a relationship over text with a guy called Robert, played by Succession's Nicholas Braun. And without going into spoilers, you sort of go on a ride with their relationship, I guess.
I mean, it starts with him sort of negging her. She works in a cinema, doesn't she, at the concession stand. And he calls her concession stand girl and is sort of negs her. And that piques her interest. So you know already at the very beginning that this relationship is based on a weird psychology. Why is she attracted to a guy that is essentially not very nice to her? He's a little bit older. She's a student. She has a very good best friend who I loved in this, who is basically the audience going, excuse me, why are you doing, what are you doing? And yeah, as you say, that this relationship progresses via text, via dates, via interactions, we'll say, and it doesn't go particularly well. But do you think it has something to say about modern dating? I mean, you know, people love this at Sundance, but equally people have sort of said it's really not realistic and it's very sort of dismissive of men and, you know, that it doesn't really portray a real relationship. What did you feel about it?
I think it's really muddled. I think it's trying to say something about the dangers and the complications and the nature of dating in the modern world. And at some points, it does say something interesting. There's a really good moment where, because she's texting Robert, and her friend's like, don't form a picture of him in your head over just his text alone, because then you're setting yourself up for when you meet him, you've got the text version of Robert over the real version of Robert. They explore that quite well, but I think it's really, really muddled, and there's no nuance. It's all very black and white. I think the ending's awful.
Yeah, agreed.
And undermines everything it's been trying to do. The last 20 minutes, probably like 20 minutes, really takes it to, like, I think you said earlier about being criticised for like being unrealistic. I think it takes it to an implausible level and also makes me lose all sympathy, really, for Margot, who I quite liked until that point and felt for, but I didn't like this movie. But I was disappointed because I think there's a nugget there.
It's
frustrating.
Yeah. It's sort of buried too deep, isn't it? There's also like a side hustle with ants in an ant nest and Isabella Rossellini, which I didn't understand what that was contributing to anything. But, you know, I liked the sort of the way that women have to negotiate men's feelings, I thought was quite well done. And the fact that even if she doesn't really like him, or even if she doesn't really want to have sex with him, she's probably going to, because it could create an environment that was uncomfortable or borderline dangerous if she didn't. So those sort of explorations I thought were quite interesting, and the sort of microaggressions that go on in dating. Yes. And the expectations of men and the expectations of women and how they don't necessarily align. But yeah, as you say, I think maybe the first half hour is really intriguing. And you're like, ooh, where are we going to go with this? And as I say, mm-hmm. the best friends, absolutely stellar, brilliant. Because we do all generally have someone in our life who's like, listen to yourself. What are you saying?
I think the character's called Taylor. Yeah, know a Taylor.
We all know a Taylor who's just like, lives on what? Reddit. yeah, like, come on now. And also, he's probably a psycho. and then, you know, you find out that maybe you are dating a psycho. So from that respect, I think it's really, really great. But then, yeah, it does seem to spiral in a direction that makes it okay to be entirely dismissive of her reservations in that half an hour. And that doesn't succeed then in what it's trying to do, which I think it's trying to do.
Yeah, the ending is so frustrating. So I did ask my friend who has read a short story how the short story ends. Completely different. And I don't understand why they changed it. I mean, that's what I found so frustrating about it. I think the filmmakers were like, right, we have this great short story. We need to turn it into a 2-hour long movie. And it just drags and drags. And then I think they wanted to sort of add something extra with this ending, but it's not pulled off at all. I think it's just really like poorly judged. There's no like malice there or anything. Like, I get what they're trying to do, but yeah, it's mishandled. There's no nuance. I found a lot of it just spelt out for me as well. Like, there's nothing subtle about it. And it's a shame, because I think Emilia Jones and Nicholas Bourne, who are very talented actors, like, they're good.
Agreed.
They're doing nothing wrong. Their performances are good. I just found it frustrating, but not in the way that the film wanted me to be frustrated with modern dating. I was frustrated at the film.
Yeah, and I don't think any of the men that are like Rob will learn anything from it either. No. They'll just be entirely justified in their behaviour. Like, well, exactly. That's what happens. Yeah, so it does feel like a missed opportunity. And sometimes I wonder about films like this, whether, you know, the original treatment was more like the short story, and then a suit from a studio came in and said, well, I need X, Y, or Z at the beginning.
Or drama.
Yeah, at the end, sorry. Amp it up. Give me a third act something. Because it feels very much like that happened here. I don't know what the history of this is, but it does feel like something happened that, like, we have to create this thing at the end. Yeah. And it doesn't quite sit with the rest of it.
It doesn't sit well at all. And when it was happening, I was like, is this really how the film is?
And then you're expecting, is somebody going to come out of the shower and say it was all a dream? Maybe that's what was happening. Because it had gone, leapt the shark so much.
Because you do have also these sort of like internal monologue thoughts, dream sequences, I guess, like throughout as well. So I like at the end was like, oh, is this just one of those? But even those scenes, I think, are just like, they're like, we need to have something to fill the runtime. And I found those uncomfortable. And you're right, but there's loads of weird tangents about like ants, etc. But it just felt like they were like, right, this is a successful short story. Let's make it into a 2-hour movie in any way we can. It's not it.
Okay, so sorry, Amelia. We really liked what you did in Coda, but I think we're saying,
Amelia.
Yeah, Cat Person is just a bit of a misfire. However, if you're intrigued, and we hope we've intrigued you rather than completely bummed you out, it is in cinemas from tomorrow. Time for some chills now and everything else with this.
It felt so real. I was in his body.
And the universe.
H.P. Lovecraft.
Who are you? Really?
Italian. Come on. Yeah. Come on. Lisa. Lisa. What have you done to me? Can't do this.
Sorry. Wrong number.
This is Suitable Flesh. It's an H.P. Lovecraft 90s horny thrillery slashery bloodfest. Emily, what's going on in it?
So we have Heather Graham here, who I know best from the Hangover movies. That's what I thought her in. I think she's great. So she plays a psychologist, doctor, who has an interesting interaction, is how I'm going to describe it, with a young patient. And she then gets drawn into this sort of world of the occult and the obscure and the supernatural. And I'm not going to say anything more because, as Jane, I know, is going to say, we should all be watching this week.
Yeah. This is absolutely delicious. It's occult, sexy, like 90s porny. It's sort of Basic Instinct-y, slivery, all of the things I absolutely love. It's very self-aware, very knowing, lots of nods to its source material and films of the past. Heather Graham in herself is a casting just genius move because she's been known for roles like this before and she plays it so heightened. And the way she's even dressed in like those Catherine Tremell outfits from Basic Instinct, you know, and runs in heels, a lot of running in heels, which is ridiculous. It's pretty horny. And when people are having sex, there's like curtains billowing in the wind and a saxophone playing. It's all overly lit like a 90s movie. It really knows what it's doing. I thought this was a hoot. How did you like it?
Yeah, I thought it was really fun. I didn't really know much about it going in. And so I will say the horror fan within me didn't find it scary at all. And so if you want a horror film that's going to terrify you, this is not that horror film.
Yeah,
it's definitely more of like a, as you say, like a supernatural erotic thriller, I guess.
Oh, and who doesn't love an erotic thriller?
I loved that. I loved that. It's like the horniest film I've seen all year.
Right.
Which is great. Heather Graham's fantastic. I don't think it's doing anything particularly new, but that's not bad when it's doing it so well. I'm so instantly drawn to her character and the sort of supernatural ongoings. And it's very weird. It's very wonderful. It plays everything at the right level of high camp. I had a lot of fun with it, like a lot of fun with it. It's got the right sort of level of like, it's gory without being too shocking. Like the gore sort of, again, part of the sort of throwback vibes, like the 80s vibes. It is definitely like entertaining. I just feel like if people are going in expecting like scares, it is just not that movie.
No, but if you love Killing Me Softly, which is a dreadful film that I adore, and Sliver and Basic Instinct, I feel like this is going to really scratch an itch. It is very silly and yeah, just incredibly self-aware. And even if you watch the trailer of it, the trailer has been designed to be like one of those crappy 90s erotic thrillers. I just think it's so clever too. And the poster, everything about it. Yeah. And also I just like the fact that they gender flipped the story. So it's from a short story by H.P. Lovecraft, which originally is a male doctor who this happens to, and they gender flipped it to a woman, and a woman who is, you know, in her late 40s, early 50s. And I think there's something really interesting about that, that it becomes a sort of discussion about a woman's sexuality, about her attractiveness, about her worth. And it just plays very differently when it's Heather Graham in a leather pencil skirt and high heels compared to a guy. You know, the spouse is this beefcake at home who's like, what are you doing? It has something quite interesting to say about gender politics as well.
I think so. I think it does help that she's just so brilliant. She really knows like how to play it. And you've got horror legend new Barbara Crampton as well, who's like her doctor friend, and it's fun seeing her on screen. I don't actually know much about the H.P. Lovecraft story, but I definitely want to like now like go back and read it to see, like, as you say, like how it sort of, how the two play together and how different it is, because I did really enjoy this.
Yeah. Don't do sexy things perched on a windowsill is all I'll say. But yeah, and if you enjoy, you know, gore, I know you say it's not frightening, but it is like nicely gory. There is blood spurting that is completely unnatural, you know, bright red, liquidy blood spurts as people's heads are chopped off and things. It's just a romp. It's something I would have my dinner with my friends, have a few bevvies and go and see this on a late night and just really get a kick out of it.
It's like two large glasses of wine kind of movie.
Absolutely, indeed. Okay, so if you fancy Suitable Flesh, that is in cinemas from Friday. Okay, surf's up for this.
The book was a gift.
This seafaring gentleman had been told about buried treasure on this island in the middle of nowhere. He described this one way, breaking off the salvage island.
I said, did you read that bit about that wave? And he went, yes!
Through surfer's eyes, that sounds like an amazing surfing wave to me.
My antenna are going, dee, 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 dee.
There's definitely the potential to find the next freak giant wave.
That's where we're going, huh?
The kids, hopefully they'll join us.
Dad just sent me a message saying the project's on.
I think it's stupid.
How's it looking, Matt?
Seems scary.
So this is Savage Waters. Emily, where are the Savage Waters that we're talking about?
So this is a documentary about skipper Matt Knight and surfer Andrew Cotton. So Matt Knight discovers this book. I mean, it's like 19th century sort of journeyman kind of adventure book about, yeah, the Savage Waters. And he's like, right, I want to go explore that area. So it's sort of his journey along with his surfer to this sort of mystical Savage Waters that he read in this Victorian adventure book.
Yeah, they're sort of 24-hour sail from Madeira. So they're in the middle of the sea, surrounded by jagged rocks, and they think that they might provide great surfing that nobody else has surfed. And that's obviously the key to any surfer's journey, to find the wave that no one else has ridden on. And obviously Matt, as you said, is a big surf rider. He rides huge surf, so he's really interested in that. But that's only really the beginning, isn't it? Like, this doc goes off in all sorts of directions, really. And actually, the Savage Waters are not really necessarily the main event. So did that work for you?
Yes and no. It's all really divided, because I think the opening's really strong, because you've got Charles Dance, like this brilliant narrator. He's narrating these extracts from this sort of 19th century treasure hunter's journal about this journey to the Savage Waters, and that's what initially inspires this adventure. And we do keep cutting back to like Charles Dance narrating these extracts. And I think I wanted to really find out more about that and sort of the relationship between this sort of book and a journey. But I think, as you say, like, it's kind of forgotten about, which I was a bit like, it's a bit torn then. But then I also did like the exploration of like these people's lives, like Matt Knight, and like learning about his family and the way his family lived and the struggles they've been through with his wife in particular and her health struggles. Like, I found the way they opened up, same with the surfer Andrew Cotton and his health, like the way they opened up about their vulnerabilities and struggles was quite emotional. I just felt maybe like a disconnect between the premises, we're going to sort of follow this book for this adventure, but also then we're going to explore all this. I think it was just torn between the two. And so I was hooked, but not completely hooked. Also helps that I have no interest in surfing. Yes. Again, a great documentary.
It shouldn't matter.
It shouldn't matter. Like, yeah. I don't know anything about Formula One. Love Senna. Like, it shouldn't matter. So I don't know if that's particularly great either. I think there's something there. I think it's just trying to do too much. And I think if it did sort of really go in on just one aspect, maybe then I would have been completely hooked, even though I don't care for surfing and don't know anything about surfing.
Yeah, no, I agree. It feels like one film is about taking this old book, that's a book that a seafaring gentleman, he's described as, in 1891, wrote about suspecting there was treasure on this island, and the adventure he took in this old ship, which was very perilous with all these rocks and everything, to find treasure. And then the idea that a modern day treasure hunter who's looking for waves instead of treasure would follow that path is one film. The other film is what the drive of surfers and the drive of adventurers and people who seek the horizon continually. And that is what Matt and his family are. They are people who have taken their kids out of school and got in a bus and driven around Mexico, and they've lived a nomadic life, doesn't care about his hair and has his wife cut little dreadlocks out of it because he just can't be asked. He wears holy jumpers. He lives for the sea, and so do his family. And that feels like another film. And that's also tied into the big wave surfing and this idea that you're addicted to it. You want to get on that wave. And the thrill of it is so intense that it keeps you hunting for that break, wherever that may be. Even that's in the middle of the ocean with no help at all if something was to go wrong. So, yeah, I felt like they should have made a decision on this. Either stick with that idea of the treasure hunting and don't go down that path, or begin again with the story of surfers and what drives them. Because I am interested in surfing. My surfing interest was peaked with Point Break. I know of that's course. not representative, but I did do surfing in California when I lived there. on a longboard, nothing like this, very, very slow progress. But I get it. And so I think it did a marvelous job of like that sense of what it's like to ride a wave. And there's some beautiful photography of people riding inside a curl and underneath that as that huge mountain of water comes over you. And the thrill of riding a break and being able to just get to the end and not be thrown off and not to wipe out. So yeah, it's sort of hit and miss, quite literally. Yeah.
That frustrated me. You are right, but it's just, it's beautiful to watch. Like, I can see why people would, especially if you're interested in surfing, like, do go see us on a big screen, because the way it captures the waves, the scenery, the nature, the sea is gorgeous. I really am interested in how they got those surfing shots as well, because it's so immersive. For me, it just needed to make a choice about what it wanted to be about, because it can't be about everything. And that's what it's trying to do. But then I also appreciate that ambition, even if they didn't pull it off.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice that something this different exists in the world. But yeah, I think people might be frustrated watching it. So would we suggest people go and see this? It is in cinemas.
I think if you're interested in surfing and you do want to see it, definitely do. But otherwise, I'd personally skip it. Yeah.
Wait for it on streaming. So that is Savage Waters. It is in cinemas from Friday. Final film now. It's time for this.
All you have to do is keep your eyes on the monitor.
Welcome to Freddy Fazbear's, where fantasy and fun come to life.
Okay.
You must be a new security guard.
Can I help you, officer?
Have you met them yet?
Met who?
Them.
So this is Five Nights at Freddy's. Emily, you didn't see this, but
no.
I would say that's a blessing.
Okay, I'm lucky that I escaped this one, am I, Jane?
So this is another Blumhouse high concept that is about a young man who is struggling with trauma from his childhood. As a child, his little brother was kidnapped. He's never got over it. He's struggling to hold down a job whilst looking after his little sister, Abby. And he gets given a job as a night security man in a disused pizzeria place, a sort of 80s throwback called Freddy's, where the children were treated to animatronic sort of robot entertainers. One's a fox, one's a chicken, one's a teddy bear. There's like an animatronic cupcake. But as he discovers, at night, something happens at Freddy's and things come alive and there's dead children a-go-go. And maybe someone we met earlier might be behind it. There's a very unconvincing policewoman that has clearly too much time on her hands and is never called out for any emergencies, but seems to pitch up most nights. And a cute kid that is clearly going to be the object of these creatures' obsession. Yeah.
It's based on a video game.
Right? It is. And so it has a sort of pixelated sort of intro beginning where it sort of makes that very clear. It's one of those things where when you transcribe that into a film, it makes no real sense. No spoilers, but the animatronic items are powered by a certain force that you have to buy into. And if you don't, then you just don't believe any of this. And if you don't believe that a animatronic teddy bear is malevolent, and if you don't get scared by that, then the scares are very, very low for this. So for my money, this was a fail. I found it tiresome, and actually one night at Freddy's would have been sufficient for me.
Oh, really? I do have a question for you. I'm a bit sick and tired of like CGI monsters and horror films. I know that the bear, etc., are like animatronics that I think are made from like the Henson's like creature company. Like, how do they look in the film? And are they scary?
Yeah, they're totally convincing, but I just don't find an animatronic cupcake ripping off a man's face that terrifying. You're like, well, how, where, what? And so if you apply any logic to it, it falls apart. And then also there's this sort of side sort of thing, which is that the security guard played by Josh Hutcherson is trying to sort of remember the detail of his brother's kidnap by putting himself in a sleep that he goes into a dream state in a kind of Freddy type way, a different type of Freddy way. And so there's that story going on as well, and that's at odds with the thing, but they all marry up at the end. And there's a casting decision right at the beginning that if you know who that person is and you understand this genre of film, then you will understand the entire plot immediately, which spoilt it somewhat for me because I was like, well, that, okay, it's probably not, oh, it is. And so for me, I guessed exactly what was going to happen. And yes, it's heightened and high concept and all of that sort of stuff. And if you enjoy the 80s and you probably went to pizzerias like this, you know, as a kid, everyone will have done, no matter whether you're from the 80s or 90s or what have you. There are places we've all been like this that possibly, if you think about it, is quite creepy. If you go to a pizza place, as I did as a kid, and they had a full-size wooden Pinocchio that looked possessed, then yes, these things might work. But for me, I just think there's more sophisticated and more interesting horror films out there to see. Fancy it?
Not really.
I haven't floated your boat on that one.
No, no. Maybe if it ends up on streaming, which I think it will soon, because I know in the US it's like direct to streaming as well as cinemas. It's like a same day release thing. Maybe I'll watch it if I'm like bored one night. Although I do fear it's just going to make me more bored.
Yeah. I mean, it's Blumhouse. You know, they do loads of these sort of films. Some are more successful than others. I just feel like this is one of their well executed, in terms of using the operative word executed, perfectly decently created, but just doesn't make any actual sense. So that is Five Nights at Freddy's, and that is in cinemas now. So that is it this week. Emily, what's your film of the week? I think I can probably guess, but tell us.
So I do want to say I did quite like The Killer. Even if I do, I'm personally frustrated, but I think I'd recommend, if anyone wants to have a good time, Suitable Flesh.
I would also agree. I was so pleasantly surprised by Suitable Flesh. A brisk running time and schlocky and knowing, absolute treat. So I think we're agreed, that's good. A reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you're all set. And also a reminder that our new issue is out, with Sir Ridley Scott celebrated and loads of great interviews with filmmakers and collaborators in there, all of them using the word genius repeatedly, which I agree with. I'm totally on board with that. Yeah. So that's it for now. It's half term. And so somebody sent a question for a listener's question. Who is the best cinematic teacher? Emily, who's your sir or miss?
There's so many choices. I'm going to go for Woody Harrelson's Grumpy But Delightful. I think it's Mr. Brunner or Brunner. I don't know how you pronounce it, but from Edge of 17.
Oh.
Wonderful coming of age film, which I still feel like not enough people have seen. So also any excuse to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
I think he just has, Woody Harrelson's amazing. And he brings such a tenderness to this role. Like, he seems really like a world-weary, kind of miserable teacher, but there's a softness to him. And what I also really like about it is, he bonds with Hayley Steinfeld's struggling student, Nadine. And there's a scene where she goes to his house and finds out he has like a family and life outside of school. And she's shocked. I mean, I'm also shocked. But then, because I feel like when you're kids, you kind of forget that your teachers are real people.
Yes, indeed.
And I really liked how that was, I think it was just perfectly pitched. So I'm that's my choice.
Totally agree. And I love that film and agree. More people should see it. If you haven't seen it, seek it out. It's an absolute cracker. Very much a sort of John Hughes-y, but with a modern twist. Very, very good. Mine would be John Keating from Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams. You know, I love that film. And even though it's boys in a boarding school, which I have no reference about, I don't understand. I do understand that idea of having a teacher that, if you go to a school and you don't feel inspired and you don't feel like it's catching any of this stuff, and then you get a teacher that really inspires you, and suddenly you understand a text that they're teaching you, and you're like, it's like the doors have opened. You're like, oh my goodness, I suddenly understand Henry IV Part 1, or Henry IV Part 2, or I suddenly understand The Grapes of Wrath. And it was a boring book before, but they have made it like actually pertinent to me and inspiring, and I'm going to write quotes of it on my wall, which I did. So Mrs. Wooler was my teacher who did that. She was incredible, and I would probably stand on a desk for Mrs. Wooler. But yeah, Dead Poets Society, Captain, my Captain. I love that. I love that scene as well. It makes me cry every single time.
I will say that I was going to pick one from an upcoming movie because I saw The Holdovers over London.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is about teachers. And it's one of my favourite films of the year. So if you do like a good film about teachers, I definitely keep an eye out for that when it comes out. I think it's January in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that's cheating. I can't pick one.
You can. It's something to look forward to. It's there something to look forward to. Yeah. Next term, next school term, there's a new teacher coming in the cinema. So on that note, we should probably say class dismissed. Thank you for your thoughts, Emily, and we'll be back next week. But for now, do say goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.
And goodbye to you.